Yeah, she's 1880.
Okay. We'll call the Health and Human Services Finance Division back to order for the evening session of Wednesday, April 15th. We have four bills left on the agenda, two from Senator Wicklund, rather, one from Senator Eakin, and one from Senator Hoffman. We're going to start with Senate File 1818. Senator Wicklund, that's not this one, I don't think. Yeah, we're starting with Senate File 1818, so we'll hand these out on the next one.
It's all good.
Senator Wicklund, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lori and committee members. And I am here today to present Senate File 1818. This is a bill that directs the Department of Health to compile one or more public use files from the All-Payer Claims Database. The All-Payer Claims Database is a state repository of healthcare claims data derived from medical providers' billing records sent to insurance companies, plan administrators, and public payers. In 2014, the legislature directed a work group to develop a framework for expanded use of the APCD. And I believe you have a handout which goes into more detail about the All-Payer Claims Database itself for your reference. This bill is a result of one of the recommendations from that work group report, which directs MDH to develop a public use file or files of summary data or tables. These files will not identify individual patients, payers, or providers. They will be available to the public for no or minimal cost, and there will be clear explanations of the characteristics of the data, such as the lack of data on uninsured patients or non-residents, or other information that's needed to provide context about the public use files. There were many members of this work group from many stakeholder groups, and this work group will continue to work on this project as it is one that will require an iterative approach. This first step is intended to start the process of expanded use of existing data. No new data will be captured. Some members of the work group are interested in moving into larger projects, but this is seen as a good first step. In the Judiciary Committee, there was also an amendment made to the bill with a provision that would make birth record contact information private. I do have an amendment that I was hoping somebody on the committee could offer.
Senator Sharon moves the A4 amendment. Senator Wicklund on that amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment deals with the first lines from 1.1 up to 1.11 has to do with the all-payer claims data provisions. It extends the timeline for delivering to March, and it provides some assurance that no additional data elements will be requested or required beyond what is authorized under this section as of June 30th of 2015. And it also provides assurance that the commissioner shall consult with the All-Payer Claims Database Work Group when doing the work to create the public use data files. So it kind of reinforces that the work group will be involved. From lines 1.12 through 1.23, adds some clarifying language requested by Senator Lori that these public birth records that the city or county would be available, be made available, would not be private elements. And it also clarifies that school means all types of schools, not just public schools. And that access to records for research purposes under specific conditions in the sections listed is still allowed.
Okay, any questions on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill itself, any questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Wicklund, did you have any testifiers you'd prepared?
I did not have any testifiers at this time. If there are questions, there are members from MDH here who can answer questions if needed.
People have questions. Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1818?
Oh, hey. I'll breathe.
Welcome to the committees. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And we have been opposed to the part of the amendment or part of the bill that has to do with the public birth data, which is lines 3.4 to 3.10. Public birth data has been public in Minnesota since the early 1900s, used by newspapers, journalists, legislators, and others. And but in February, we started using this data in order to notify parents of the fact that the health department has the child's DNA and is able to use it without consent for research. Essentially, this is unknown by parents, and we found that this, since consent was repealed last year, we found that this was the only way that we would be able to actually notify parents of the fact that this is happening and they have the right to opt out. So what we did was we sent the opt-out form to the parents and provided them with an envelope to send it to the health department. And so this is the only way that we can actually make known to parents what we consider to be an egregious violation of their genetic privacy and the privacy of their baby. So, in other words, we oppose the original language. Now, when it comes to the amendment to the language, it's also a concern to us of the fact that here specifically researchers are going to be having access to this data without the parents' consent. So not only do researchers have access to the genetic testing results of the child and to the child's DNA for any studies related to newborn screening, which, as Representative Mary Liz Holbrook said on the floor of the House, could be anything because they use a newborn screening blood spot. Now they would also have access to not only the public part of the birth certificate, but also the huge private part of the birth certificate, which in a study that we recently conducted, we found that Minnesota collects 174 potential data elements on that birth certificate. And I can assure you that parents do not know either about the private part of the birth certificate or the fact that the state is using birth registration as an opportunity to collect this information on families and children. So we're not pleased at all with the idea that the researchers would also have access without parent consent, but we as an organization would no longer have access to tell parents about the fact that their child's DNA is being held by the health department, used, potentially shared, analyzed, given for research, whatever. So we oppose the that part of the language and the amendment as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any questions of members? Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is pretty controversial, and I'm not sure how it ended up here. Rich Neumeister, I actually asked some pretty serious questions about birth certificates, and Rich Neumeister spent a good half hour with me explaining how it had always been public, and so I'm not sure that this should just sail through without it being an independent, standalone bill going through judiciary with public testimony. And so, Mr. Chair, I would move to strike Section 3.
Senator Benson moves to delete Section 3 from the bill. Discussion on that motion. Senator Benson, this isn't a new issue. it has been discussed before, and it has had some controversy in the past. It's been attempted before because new parents are often disturbed by commercial activity trying to learn who new parents are and reach out to them to sell them diapers, to sell them life insurance for their babies, to sell them different formula to use it for marketing purposes. And that's not the purpose of vital statistics. And this has been tried before, though we are aware of the endeavor that Ms. Bray's mentioned she has started as well. That has also come up with some parents not welcoming unsolicited information coming to them because of the fact that they've had a medical procedure, that their address is public by virtue of that. And so what this is following up on something. The way it had been attempted in the past was to make the entire birth certificate private, and that raised significant objections. And again, it's been tried in prior years before this new issue came up. And the Minnesota Newspaper Association and folks who did research in ancestry and things like that had a great deal of concerns. So in this approach, where we're just eliminating the actual contact information so that it can't be used for those commercial purposes to contact individuals who have had a particular medical procedure about their medical procedure, that's what we're doing, and it did have public testimony in the judiciary, is my understanding. This amendment was adopted in the Judiciary Committee with a debate. Is that correct, Senator Wicklund?
That's correct, Senator Loring.
Okay. So further comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
Why aren't we making birth certificates private? Was that debated? I mean, you said this was controversial. I think it deserves some standalone attention. And moving from judiciary into finance and then ending up in an omnibus bill is not transparent. This is a significant change in policy. And then we have the amendment that adds Section 4, where persons performing medical research. So could Medtronic get this data because they perform medical research? Was that clarified?
Maybe.
Mr. Chair, if somebody could.
Maybe the department could come and explain the mechanisms. Council described this as a technical conforming amendment. Is there somebody from the Department of Health? Ms. Rydrick, welcome to the committee as you work your way forward.
Welcoming me before I've even arrived.
So, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Diane Rydrick. I'm the director of the Health Policy Division at MDH. And I'll warn you that I may need to phone a friend on this, but I'll try and start at kind of a higher level. Medical researchers currently have access to birth record data, both the medical information and the demographic information. So the changes here don't make any changes to what researchers already have access to. It just clarifies that they still have that access, even to information that is now private. When requests come in for medical research, we look at the entity that's making the request. Is it a university? Is it an academic institution? Is it, you know, legitimate, coming from a legitimate research organization? I don't believe we've ever gotten any requests from a Medtronic, so we'd have to think about how we would evaluate that and whether that would be considered medical research.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Senator Benson.
Medtronic, it was my proxy for, what if there's a biotech firm who, you know, wants this information, or somebody who's doing statistical analysis on medical research that parallels what MDH does, who would like access to this information? I don't know what the department defines as medical research, but if I may, Mr. Chair and Ms. Roderick, did the department bring the language that's in Section 3?
Ms. Rydrick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, no, we did not. We provided some technical assistance on both the original amendment that was added in Judiciary and for tonight's amendment, but it did not originate with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think this is worthy of a standalone discussion, Mr. Chair, and I'll renew my motion.
Any further discussion on Senator Benson's motion?
Well, I just would
Senator Sharon.
I would vote against the motion by Senator Benson. I don't know what we mean by controversial. There's always disagreements about data. It's always controversial. But this concept is not been. It's been not the original right. movement that you were talking about, which was quite extreme. But just last year, we've continued to establish in judiciary restrictions on the names and addresses of people who are giving their information for some purpose, for government purpose, to the general public. And for whatever use, you know, some of us think it's great use, others of us think it isn't. We don't want the department having to make those decisions. Just last year, as I said, in the Judiciary Committee, there was a motion to restrict the use of electronic email addresses, even though they're in the public sector because they were defined as publicly available. But the argument was made that that ought not be public information. Now, I, in that case, am a person that experienced a restriction because I was one of those people who wanted to have access to that information for my very solid and high-ended purposes. But I had to confront the truth of the situation, which is, that's not the reason that people gave that information to the public, to the government, and it wasn't what they expected it would be used for. So I accepted that principle at that time, and I accept that principle again here, that it restricts the use of it for purposes that are beyond what the government has collected and it wants to utilize the information for. It's not for general public use.
And I think, Senator Sharon, you highlighted a point that I made. The controversy was in prior years when we tried to make the entire birth record private, and it would restrict, births being published in the paper. This would allow that. You know, the birth is public. It's got the city and the state, so you can identify that these folks had a birth. People doing genetic research later on can use those publications and find their ancestors, and all these publicly beneficial uses would still be allowed to occur, but that direct contact for commercial purposes or whatever purposes with somebody who's had a medical event in their lives is what would be precluded from this. And the controversy, so the Minnesota Newspaper Association in former iterations of this objected strenuously, and it did fail in previous attempts to make the entire birth record private. This is a much more restricted approach, and the Minnesota Newspaper Association has remained neutral on this and said that, yeah, this would allow their communication with the public record, the ability to do the ancestry and things like that that people really value, and that is a real core purpose for this data that has a long and robust tradition, but the direct contacting immediately following a medical procedure has troubled many new parents, myself included. 20 some years ago, we were bombarded, with commercial appeals to buy things for our kids and TV shows that I'd never heard of. I mean, and just, it was actually pretty alarming. And so this one here, there's some that don't agree with it, but I think it's, I think we should keep Section 3 myself. I'll be voting against, with respect, I'll be voting against your amendment.
And
any further discussion? Senator
Mr.
Benson.
Chair, you represented a position of the newspapers. I had not heard any testimony from the newspapers. Did they give that, if Senator Wicklund could tell us if they gave testimony in Judiciary that they had no objection?
Senator Benson, I'm Senator Wicklund.
Senator Benson, Chair Laurie, Senator Benson. The amendment was offered by Senator Sharon in Judiciary. We had some testimony. I do not believe they testified in Judiciary.
They were in the room, though, I think. I know the Newspaper Association pretty well. I used to own one. I don't anymore, and I worked with those folks long before I was ever elected. And so, you know, I know a lot of their folks just from a previous life, and I do. I've talked with them a few times, and they think this is a reasonable approach that still allows that public use that is valuable but restricts that private commercial use in a way that can move us forward. Any further discussion? Senator Benson.
It's interesting, Mr. Chair. Newspapers are private commercial entities, and they're happy to protect their data as long as they get access to what they want. So I will discuss no further. There are some private commercial entities that are okay and some that aren't, and I will leave it at that.
On Senator Benson's motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Any further questions on Senate File 1818? Ms. Brace?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make one more comment about the statement about, you know, parents showing some concern. I would also like to say that we have had several hundred parents contact us to thank us for letting them know what they didn't know. And their biggest comment is, thank you, no one told us, or thank you, we didn't know. And that, of course, was always our concern with the fact when parent consent was taken away, that the opt-out would never provide the kind of information that parents need in order to make an informed consent to protect their baby's genetic information. And the last thing I wanted to say was about the research piece. And someone said, we don't want the department to make those kind of decisions about who gets access. But in fact, the health department will make a decision that certain researchers will get access and certain researchers won't get access. And parents will have no choice, even though they might object to how the data will be used about them. They will have no choice. So again, we oppose it.
Well, Ms. Braze, you know, one of the things you've said several times is that there's no other way to contact parents. And that is just not true. I mean, there are ways without contacting them through their email or their direct mail to them by virtue of finding their information on public sources. You can go, you know, you can find out how to contact them through parenting classes. I know you personally, your organization has bought billboards and does different, you know, public service announcement type approaches, a general public awareness type approach to broaden the awareness of your issue. Without that direct contact that some appreciate and many don't. And I think that that's what this is attempting to accomplish.
Mr.
So
Chair.
Any further questions of members? Seeing none. Ms. Braze, briefly.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are a small organization. Now, if we had the funding of the state, we might be able to put billboards all over like they're putting billboards over on the newborn screening. But the interesting thing about their newborn screening billboards is that they really don't tell a story because most doctors don't even know about the storage and use of the child's DNA. So I just want to make clear that we're a small organization. The easiest way for us to do this is in a way where we actually can find parents and we know who they are in order to protect their babies.
Senator Sharon.
Well, I just want to redirect. The focus of this is not about giving one group or another access to information to do what Ms. Brace is talking about doing. That's a very separate subject. It's a very separate subject. This is about establishing some boundaries on what the government can, who the government can give information to, and. It is a situation in which I will experience the limitation on my ability to have access to use it for my good purposes, which I believe are good purposes and others don't always agree with. And the other issue about opt-in, opt-out, how to get communication is not the subject here. It's not the subject here. The subject is, and it was accepted in judiciary, that this particular a set of information should be kept private and not distributed to the general public for general public purposes for which the information was not gathered. And we've done it before, we're doing it here, and we're pretty committed to whenever this emerges and becomes visible that we do it again in the future.
Any further questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1818, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklund. You have one more bill before us. Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair Laurie. Yes, I do have.
Senate File 1056. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lurie and committee members. I have Senate File 1056. This bill relates to organ donation amongst underserved communities, a new grant program. This would create a grant program to develop culturally appropriate education and culturally appropriate education and advocacy programs about the importance of organ donation. This program would be conducted in accordance with advocacy groups, advocacy programs with members of historically underserved communities. The proposal aims to build on and expand the good work currently being done by Hennepin County Medical Center and their Circle of Life federal grant with a number of American Indian tribes across the state. That project is slated to conclude at the end of 2015. Senate File 1056 would allow that work and momentum of the project to continue. There is a need for this program in American Indian communities because the percentage of the population authorizing donation is very low, less than 40%. And American Indians also experience a high need for transplantation as a result of kidney and liver disease. Program components would include training that has been developed in the community, education through community-based events, outreach through media, research on effectiveness of the program. The bill proposal received a resolution of support from the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and it was a unanimous vote of support for this bill proposal. The grant program is also in line with work that MDH is doing to address health disparities. Today, I do have an amendment. It makes a couple of technical clarifications that council recommended, and then also adds a statement regarding doing a report on the grant program at the end of the time. If that would be something one.
Senator Herr moves the A1 amendment. And I think it's been described. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you. Now I'd like to ask the testifiers to give you some more information about what the program involves, and I have Susan Gunderson, who's the CEO of LifeSource, and also I have Barb Danielson here to testify, and I'm not sure which one would like to go first.
Whichever wishes to go first, state your name for the record and provide your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Susan Gunderson, and it's my privilege to serve as the Chief Executive Officer with LifeSource, and I'm pleased to be here today to support Senate File 1056, a bill to establish a grant program to increase organ donation among underserved communities. LifeSource is the federally designated not-for-profit organization that coordinates organ and tissue donation for Minnesota and North and South Dakota. For 25 years, we've had the privilege of serving families at the time of great loss and grief to make decisions to support others by providing the gifts of life of organ and tissue donation. It's work we take seriously. It's a commitment to the Minnesota that we appreciate and want to move forward. A critical component of our mission is to provide education and outreach to all Minnesotans to ensure they have information about donation, a means to register as donors, and to know that their wishes will be honored. 64% of Minnesotans have registered their intent to donate. However, some communities have historically demonstrated a lower rate of support. On one of the materials you've been provided today, you will see that within different communities, donation rates vary from over 60% to less than 30%, and that is the experience in the Native American community in Minnesota right now. This bill would allow us to develop better ways to engage with them and potentially with other groups in the future. Organ donation is a life-saving gift. At the same time, donation can represent a more cost-effective course of treatment, and that's critically important information as well. As an example, in your packets, you have a handout taken from a recent National Institutes of Health study. It has two graphs on it, and it shows the cost savings of a kidney transplant compared to ongoing dialysis treatment. I would just point to this handout two key messages. There's a significant patient survival benefit to receive transplant over dialysis, and there is a significant cost benefit for these patients to receive a transplant as compared to remaining on hemodialysis. Senate File 1056 would create a grant program within the Department of Health to provide funds to Minnesota's federally designated organ procurement organization and all other transplant centers to create and implement culturally appropriate outreach and advocacy programs. Initially, the program would look to expand on a similar federal project Hennepin County Medical Center is currently engaged in with several Minnesota tribes called Circle of Learning, and Ms. Danielson will describe that briefly. The requested amount is based on the budget in that federal initiative. The funds would be allocated towards tribal outreach coordinators, campaign development, community events, an advisory council, and personnel to coordinate the program. The requested amount would also cover monies for a research consultant to importantly evaluate the effectiveness of the program. The research will include a baseline assessment of support for donation prior to beginning the program and an assessment at the end of the program to determine effectiveness. It will also include recommendations on how to build upon and sustain this initiative in the future. And this report will be shared with the state legislature and made publicly available. Effective collaboration and community participation will be critical to the success of this program. There are four organ transplant centers in our state: the University of Minnesota, Hennepin County Medical Center, Abbott Northwestern Hospital, and the Mayo Clinic. They will all be invited to be partners in this important work. As was mentioned earlier, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council has adopted a unanimous resolution in support of this bill, and the Department of Health has communicated that the proposal aligns with their work in addressing health disparities. I'd like to thank you for considering Senate File 1056. I'd also like to mention that April is Donate Life Month, and I would encourage each of you to consider the opportunity to help others through the life-giving gift of organ and tissue donation. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gunderson. And you have another testifier, Ms. Anderson, is that correct?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Barb Danielson, and I'm the transplant nurse administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm here to express support for SF 1056 to develop a grant program to increase donation among underserved communities. As you know, HCMC functions as a safety net hospital supporting Hennepin County and the state of Minnesota. HCMC performs the highest percentage of minority patients in Minnesota and 5% of all American Indians in Minnesota, ranking fourth highest nationally in the last 25 years. American Indians experience an excessive burden of chronic kidney disease. In fact, they are six times more likely to have kidney disease due to diabetes. Transplantation is the treatment of choice and the most cost-effective for patients with chronic kidney disease. Minority transplant rates fall far behind those of Caucasians. One of the most significant barriers for minority communities is access to education regarding kidney donation and transplantation. In 2012, we applied for and were awarded a three-year HRSA grant to develop a new approach to providing a culturally based living kidney donation education program in the places where American Indians receive community-based health services. The project is being conducted in collaboration with South Dakota State University and LifeSource and is called the Circle of Learning for American Indians. Development of the program was informed by the help of community focus groups, a community advisory committee, and clinical advisory board. The education program is being tested for effectiveness using a two-group randomized trial in both rural and urban settings. Each site employs a tribal outreach coordinator who's a trusted member of the community, and they deliver the education, and they have a close connection to the medical team for questions. We believe that the educational materials and tribal outreach coordinators will be a valuable resource for the community once the project is complete this year. To date, the feedback from the community is extremely positive, and the initial results are very good. This bill would allow expansion of our project to include education about deceased donation for American Indian communities and serve as a basis to develop programs in other minority communities that experience similar barriers. It would not only benefit the minority populations, but also all patients waiting for life-saving transplants at all four transplant centers in Minnesota and beyond that. On behalf of all the patients waiting for a life-saving organ, please support this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Danielson. Are there any questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1056? Seeing none, Senator Wicklund, any additional thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I would like to say that I strongly support the bill, and I think it adds a unique component in that it works, has people working within the American Indian community to make sure that all of the materials developed are culturally appropriate and will have the best chance of increasing the organ donation rate.
Okay, thank you. Senator Herb moves that Senate File 1056 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. Recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Senator Hoffman, we have Senate File 1062.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about Senate File 1062. At the table with me, just to be here to answer questions if you'd like, are Lynn Noren and Kevin Goodnow. But, Mr. Chair and members, I want to take us back to when microphones weren't from Radio Shack. Sorry about that. When we talked about getting a system to determine the medical assistance payments rates for providers who serve people with disabilities in the community, and this bill is a continuing effort to adjust that disability waiver rate system, or DWRS, as it transforms from county-by-county rate setting system, which we had known for years, to one that meets the federal government's requirement of a statewide uniform rate setting methodology. And if you recall, Mr. Chair, that there was a small group of individuals that got together just to make sure that this was an ongoing conversation so that at the end of the 5 years we would have a good product in front of us and that would have no adverse effects on the people most vulnerable in the state of Minnesota that we serve. And so the new statewide system began in January of 2013 after many years of work and in the development, including much negotiation and collaboration. And to this date, that continues on. In implementing the new system, there are two concepts that guided the implementation strategy. The first, of course, was move to the uniform methodology while maintaining budget neutrality. No more or no less money would be spent in the system because of the change in the methodology. The second was to make sure that safeguards are in place to not only protect people with disabilities in Minnesota, but also to protect the infrastructure of the community-based services that support them in their day-to-day lives during the transition to new systems. Senate File 1062 continues to move the DWRS system forward by improving in the integrity of the system and continued for the needed protections. And with that, you know, we're originally going to try to get in this body on Monday, but we've had a companion also going on the House, the same conversations in both bodies, and know that we'll be coming together. And so there are still some 4 points that continually need to be worked on, and I know there's been some movement in the House. That's why I'm not bringing any amendments. Mr. Chair, I'm just asking that you trust our integrity, that we're working together, both agencies and counties and the advocates are working together to keep moving this forward. But there's still the day services factory. There's a small budget issue on unit base, shared staff concern, which is one that is being addressed, and then address the exception process. And with that, Mr. Chair, this is more or less just an update to say that we are continually going forward, and there are some suggested changes from the House that we'll probably bring over, but just allow us to keep this work going.
Okay, and I think in order to bring the bill in shape to match with the fiscal note, I think we're supposed to adopt the A5 amendment. Is that your understanding as well, Senator Hoffman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and again, I will talk more about the A5 amendment some other time, but in order to going with the rules of this committee, yes, we'd have to accept that. That's not what it's going to be at the end of the day. So.
Right. Senator Eakin moves the A5 amendment to bring the dates in line with what the fiscal note reflects. Any further discussion on that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any further testimony, Senator? Any questions of Senator Hoffman? All right. Anyone else in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1062? Seeing none. Seeing one, I guess. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Jerry Peterson. I'm here as a representative of the Minnesota Association of Social Services Administrator, MACSA. And our association has been working with the stakeholders that were referenced, and we're very pleased with what's been, you know, the discussion and what's going on. Just wanted to go on record for a couple things because there isn't an amendment that reflects some of the work that's done. So just wanted to go on record with just a couple notes from the county association. One is that there's due to the complexities of managing these waiver systems and the two different systems that are being talked about through this amendment, that there is a provision in there that for smaller counties, it allows the commissioner not to require a corrective action plan based on his discretion, and that's been talked about in the stakeholder groups. And the other is that to address that the two different waiver management system, that the enactment dates for the specific one around the CCB waiver system is stretched out and put out farther than immediate enactment, which would be reflected of the DD waiver system. So just wanted to go on record for those two things and doing some of the shuffling going on here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mm-hmm. Any further? Yeah, Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, we're looking at almost 30 FTEs in 2016. Could I get some explanation? I know there's a lot of moving pieces here, but are we fundamentally changing the population we're dealing with? What is driving the workload?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I know
Senator Hoffman.
That's under negotiation right now to remove those FTEs, and that was a discussion that started in the House. But you're right; there's a lot of moving parts on this, and that one is considered still part of the negotiations.
Senator Benson, do you want more information on the use of the FTEs?
Mr. Chair, I guess Senator Hoffman does good work, so please don't think I'm not believing that you're straightforward. Could you fill us in a little bit on what some of the House discussions might have been so we can get a sense of direction? I don't think anybody's going to oppose this because it's something that we need to do, but this is a lot of money.
Oh, absolutely. Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Senator Benson, it's exactly why when Senator Rosen and I put ourselves on this bill 2 years ago, it was to know that this was going to be continued discussion until we get to the 5 years that's ended. And although I wasn't over at the other body Monday night, the gentleman sitting next to me was, and also Ms. Hamilton from the Department of Human Services was there too, and talking jointly. So, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Goodnow could probably go deeper in the weeds on that discussion over at the other body.
Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Kevin Goodnow with the Minnesota Organization for Rehabilitation and Rehabilitation, here on behalf of the DWRS Coalition. Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, the fiscal note, our intent in the negotiations is to remove the fiscal costs that are reflected in the fiscal note. There are some major components within the fiscal note that major components in the bill that led to this large fiscal note. One is shared staffing. We do have tentative agreement on how to address that and remove that fiscal cost. Another one is the day service factor components. We're working on an agreement on that as well. Another one is the adjustment to the budget neutrality factor related to unit-based services. We're working on that, and we think we're close to an agreement on that as well. And then there's some other small fiscal impacts. So the intent in the end is that we would move away from the need to have any additional FTEs in this bill. Part of the issue was that we didn't get the fiscal note until right before the hearing in the House and weren't able to address some of those issues before that time. So that's a factor. So our intent is really to bring this fiscal note down as close to zero as possible.
It's a long way to go.
Mr. Chairman.
I have a nice little music behind it.
Sorry, Mr. Goodnow.
I can feel the love, man. Senator.
So, I was just sitting here. Yeah.
Ms. Bartolik, did you wish to add some insights, or did you want a promo? Senator Rosen, can you a drum roll?
I can handle that.
Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's true. This is a complex process. We've been working very hard to amend the original bill that the fiscal note was based on, and we are working very hard that it will be significantly different when we are finished with the amendments.
Okay. Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hoffman, I know that this has been a long journey for you, and it has not been loosey-goosey. It's been... No, actually, I do think I commend you and hope that you can continue to work forward, and we'll find the solution here.
Wait a minute.
One time.
Senator Benson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe this is going to be moved to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. Are we going to have some good discussions about what happens when this fiscal note is significantly reduced? I just want to call that out because this is good work, huge fiscal note, and if by some miracle it gets down to a reasonable amount that it doesn't kill your target, I would like to know how that happened. We're taking Senator Hoffman at his word, and I will move forward with that, but I want to see how this works.
So, Senator Benson, just a little insight, I suppose. If this gets done, you know, this is on the table, this basic proposal. Obviously, this is larger than our entire target, so it doesn't fit. But if they're able to work it and there's pieces of it that can work, you know, in compiling the budget bill, we need to reprice many of the items that are on the table and make the adjustments to make the language fit what we're able to afford, and then we'll roll out a bill. And if some of this is in it, we'll describe what it is and how it changed and how much it costs. There will be a line on the fiscal note that'll say, you know, this package that started as Senate File 1062 now costs this, and you'll see it on the spreadsheet, and we'll be able to point you to the language in the bill and have a discussion, and Senator Hoffman will be able to give us some additional insights into exactly how we got there. But many of the proposals on the table will have to go through a similar process as we try to make them fit within the constraints of a target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a particularly large number. To go from $400 million to zero would be some special sort of magic, and I would like to see how that happens.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
And Mr. Chair, let me just add to that, and then I want Mr. Goodnow to say some remarks. I just leaned over to Alex Martolik, and we're now this system, when you look at the comprehensive system that we're talking about, is almost $2 billion of supports and services to our most vulnerable in the state of Minnesota. So, yeah, it is a big number, and we are watching. That's where that budget neutrality comes from, and it's the drive and the desire to get us in there, and so we're going to keep that going. And with that, I'll have Kevin say some things.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Goodnow.
Kevin Goodnow again. Senator Benson, just to give you an example, it's the bill itself had some language in it that DHS interpreted one way that was not intended by us when we drafted the language. And, you know, a good portion of that, for example, on shared staffing, there's about $1 million of costs attributed. That's total cost, federal and state, attributed to that on page 8 that we've already been able to.
Only $414 million to go.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's other factors that.
That should have brought the amendment.
Yeah, that number is zero now. So it's not necessarily magic. It's just correcting the errors and making sure that our assumptions are the same and what we're trying to accomplish. So I wish it were as easy as magic.
Yes.
Or, yeah.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anyway. Well, I, too, would like to thank Senator Hoffman for digging into this. That there's probably only about a dozen people in the state that really understand the system, and our past commissioner does truly understand that. And obviously we have a long ways to go on this, but thank you for taking this on. This is a very brave move. Continue the fight. And with that, I'd like to move Senate File 1062. As amended, for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill.
On Senator Rosen's motion, is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And last on the agenda is Senator Eakin with Senate File 646. Senator Eakin, welcome to the committee. Senator Eakin, I see this is your first hearing.
Yeah,
you have an A1, so that would be right at this point. That would be considered an author's amendment.
Well, and Mr. Chair, we've decided not to add that amendment at this time.
You're not going to put on the author's amendment. The fiscal note is not drafted to the amendment, it appears. Is that correct?
That's correct, and that's one of the reasons we decided not to add the amendment.
So members can just put that amendment away and on the bill. Senator Eakin.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 646 is a bill asking for a 10% rate increase for home and community-based services. It's also known as the 5% bill, but that's it's actually 5% in the coming year that's being requested, and then 5% in the next year, so for a total of 10%. And this bill is designed to address one of the biggest challenges of our time, which is to make sure that Minnesota provides quality care for persons with disabilities and older adults who live in our communities. And it's one of the greatest challenges of our times because of the baby boomers who are now reaching the age when many of them will be needing services in the community. People with disabilities are now living much longer than they did just 20 years ago. One example of that would be those with Down syndrome. The life expectancy in 1983 for those with Down syndrome was actually 25 years old. Today, it's 60, so it's over doubled in those years. And obviously, this is a great thing, but it means that more people now need services, support, and care. And obviously, those disabilities become more of a problem as one is aging. Using the Down syndrome example again, they have a much higher rate of Alzheimer's disease. Some studies have shown that Those who are over 60 years old with Down syndrome are 60 or 75% of all those over 60 have Alzheimer's. So requiring much more intensive care and finding themselves in situations where their parents or their siblings can't take care of them any longer. So the needs are increasing. At the same time, our workforce is shrinking because of the baby boomers leaving the workforce. This means that more people need services with fewer caregivers to help them. And as our economy improves, the low-paid caregivers are finding higher-paying jobs to support their families, and stability has become a real issue. And stability is extremely important to the quality of life for those who receive these services. So this bill helps to assure the resources are there for the quality of life and the quality of care for our most vulnerable citizens, which requires us to provide living wages to their caregivers and the providers. And that's one of the reasons that this bill does have within it a 75% encumbrance to ensure that at least 75% of that 5% is going to be going towards compensation for the care providers. We did provide a 5% rate increase for these programs last year. Still, over the past 10 years, rates have gone up 10.4%, while caregivers' costs of living has increased more than twice that at 23.3%. For these reasons, we ask for your support for a 10% rate increase for home and community-based services for older adults and Minnesotans with disabilities and some 90,000 caregivers. So this bill would provide, again, a 5% rate increase in the coming year and another 5% in the following year for the next 2 years for older adults and people with disabilities who are supported in home and community-based services for a total of 10%. And I do have with me today two who would like to testify to the bill. I have with me Pam Ganella, who is a parent advocate and also a former president of ARC, among many other things. And also Chris Rosenthal, who is the Senior Services Director for the Jewish Family Service of St. Paul. And I guess we can, if we could begin with Pam, that would be great. So.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Pam Ganella, and I live in Eagan. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'd like to talk about this bill and talk about the extreme importance of the caregivers for our daughter with disabilities. We are the parents of three children, but our daughter, Sarah, is the one that I'll be talking about. In addition to my work at the ARC of Minnesota for many years, I'm also currently on the board of directors of Living Well Disability Services, which operates the group home where my daughter is now living. It's an ICF, and there are six people living there, and they have 24-hour supervision. And I know it's corny, but I just wanted to bring this. This is a picture of Sarah and her two brothers. And her two brothers have been just wonderful for her. And I know that they will take care of her for many years to come. And I just wanted you to see what this love we have in our family for her. I'll start out with Sarah's story here. Sarah was born a normal child. On her first birthday, and again a few months later, she had febrile seizures when she had an illness. When she was about three, we had to rush her to the hospital. She also had seizures at that time. Turns out she had Hib meningitis, which is bacterial meningitis. They took care of her. She was in the hospital for 11 days on IV antibiotics. Now there is a vaccine to prevent Hib, but at the time this happened in 1988, they did not have that. And we thought at that point, because one of the doctors told us, gee, it's really great that we found out what was going on with Sarah, because if we hadn't, her brain would be gone by morning. And taking that in was just so much for us. And we thought that we had experienced the worst we would ever go through with our child. But we were wrong. When Sarah was 5 years old, this was in 1988, she was having
symptoms of a flu, vomiting, diarrhea. We kept taking her into the doctor. They said, it's just a viral infection. It's a viral infection. They finally put her in the hospital at Ridges Hospital in Burnsville and to rehydrate her. And at 5 o'clock the next morning, she had massive seizures. She had to be placed on a respirator, and she had a body temperature of 105.8. The doctor that came from Minneapolis Children's to help transport her did not think she would live from Burnsville to Minneapolis, but she did. She was in the hospital for a total of 4 months between Minneapolis Children's and the Gillette Children's Hospital Brain Injury Program. The neurologists have told us that basically she lost about 30% of her brain kind of randomly. She's no longer able to speak. We have to feed her, dress her, bathe her, help her in all of her activities of daily living. And she still has an ongoing seizure disorder, so she has to wear a helmet because she can fall. She also, because of her brain injury, she doesn't regulate her body temperature, so all summer long we have to have spray bottles all around so we can make sure that she doesn't start building up a temperature. She requires constant supervision because she also has some partial blindness. There's just no brain cells there to get the message from her eyes. It's called cortical blindness. She can trip on things as she walks around, and so we always had to make sure that things were out of the way, like the dog. So, but when she was in the hospital, we vowed that we would take care of her at home. But we knew at the time that this was a really tall order for us, because at that time, her brothers were 4-year-olds, and her youngest brother was 10 days old when this happened. We knew that we were going to need help. And this was where ARC entered my life. One of our neighbors had a child with disabilities. She came over to me and when she heard what had happened with Sarah, and she said, listen, this is what you have to do. You go file for TEFRA. Sarah got sick in June of 88. TEFRA started in July of 88. And then she told me that you should go for some training at Partners in Policymaking, and then you should come on the ARC board with me. And when she told me that, this was the best advice I've ever received in my life. So in order to care for her at home, we applied for medical assistance under the TEFRA program, and they provided personal care attendants that would help us in our home. Without that help, we couldn't have done this. We actually took care of Sarah at home for 25 years. And these direct support caregivers were part of our family. I know when we're talking about the short term, that people work in this field sometimes and the lack of staff, we had two wonderful blessings in our family called Mary and Etzetta, and they were people who worked with us. Mary worked with us for 24 years, and Etzetta worked with us for 17 years. I often tell people that I'm mother number one, but Mary and Etzetta are mothers number two and three for Sarah. She has three mothers to love her. They worked with us for a long time because they loved Sarah, that flat out. And I know that most of the caregivers in this field don't have near that longevity in terms of being with one family with consistent care like that. Sarah attends a day program at Midwest Special Services. There she has other wonderful direct service caregivers that help her. She loves going there, and she's been going there for 10 years. My husband and I, as we've gotten older, have finally decided that we were really not able to keep caring for her at home the way we had. It was kind of like when Mary and Etzetta were really, it was kind of like breaking up the family, really. It was that difficult to do. Sarah is now living at Living Well, one of their homes in Mendota Heights. It's a 5-person intermediate care facility. She has... or it says it's 6 people there. She has wonderful caregivers there, but even
I have noticed there that the turnover is quite amazing. I mean, two of the people that have been there the last 2 years are gone now, and others have left also. And I know, even though I know that this field has, because of the low wages, and the, we have to just admit that the work can be sometimes very difficult too. But I know also at between Midwest Special Services and Living Well that there are some people who have worked in this field for a long time, and they have devoted their lives, and I feel that they also need recognition for what they do. I just feel strongly that these caregivers are so essential for us to have kept Sarah happy, safe, healthy, and loved for all of these years. And I really believe that they should be fairly compensated for the important and challenging work that they do to provide quality of care for people with disabilities in communities all over Minnesota. So I would ask that you would pass this bill and give them a raise that they deserve for the work that they do. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Eakin, you have one more testifier. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Chris Rosenthal, and I'm the Senior Services Director at Jewish Family Service. And I, too, want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for this opportunity to speak in support of Senate House File 646. Jewish Family Service is a nonprofit organization serving the East Metro area for 100 years. In fact, I think this year we celebrate our 105th anniversary, so we have long and deep roots in the community. I'm here to address case management services provided under the elderly waiver and the need for an increase. The primary waiver service that JFS provides is case management. We have 15 case managers who provide case management for about 700 older adults. We serve a very diverse population of older adults that includes 260 Russian Jewish refugees, 180 Somali elders, and a mixture of clients from other ethnic and cultural groups, including a large number of old-fashioned older adults who've grown up and grown old in Minnesota. So just to summarize about case management usually includes a visit to the client's home with the client and often with family members around, and we look at strengths and the needs of the clients, determine what other waivered services these clients need and other community services to support that client in his or her home, and then develop a plan that we continue to monitor with these clients over time. At JFS, we have historically provided case management to the same clients for years, some even for a decade or more. We have over 100 clients in their 90s and even a few in their hundreds now, which I think speaks to the success of the Elderly Waiver Program to keep people living in the community successfully. But it also speaks to the success of having consistent case management staff, which we have had for years. We have had some case managers on staff for as many as 17 years. We are very grateful for the 5% increase that was passed during the last legislative session, and I know you are all aware of the economic downturn and what it did to a lot of smaller nonprofits, just like JFS, and we had to institute pay cuts, so the 5% was very helpful in restoring salaries. However, so within the past year, we seem to have arrived at a new juncture for our case management services. We have had 5 case managers submit their resignations within the past year and 2 within the past month. They have all taken positions with healthcare entities that can pay approximately 25 to 30% more than we can afford to pay. We are simply not able to compete with those current levels, and the social workers are not pounding at our doors with their resumes for the new positions that we have open, where historically they have in the past. So we now primarily recruit from the field of new social work grads whom we train well. We provide excellent supervision to meet licensure requirements, and then we find they are now moving on to other positions to receive higher salaries, and who could blame them? This has an impact on the morale of our staff, but it is a significant quality of life issue as it relates to the continuity of care for our clients whom we provide case management services. It takes time to build trusting relationships, especially with clients from other ethnic and cultural populations. Trusting relationships promote effective case management services, which then turn into good client outcomes, which then offer an overall higher quality of life as experienced by our clients, and they tell us this. An increase, 5%, 10%, will move us closer towards closing the salary gap. It won't make it, but it will certainly help us. And so we then can continue the high quality and our commitment to providing these case management services for older adults. So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Rosenthal. Any questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone additional in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 646? Seeing none, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as you have heard, the critical importance of this bill to the quality of life to those receiving these services, and the fact that you mentioned how much longer people with disabilities are living, a large part of that is due to the fact that the home and community-based services are providing them with that quality of life that they didn't enjoy in the institutional setting. And I know that it's a large ask. The fiscal note is very high, but the needs are very great. So thank you for allowing us to be heard today. Appreciate it.
And Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 646 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin. And we are done with the agenda for today. We are not getting back together tomorrow, but we have a few bills that we weren't able to get done. I think Prior Auth and Bill are the two primary large ticket items that still had a little bit of work to be done, and a few other stragglers. So we'll be getting together Friday at 8:30. And with that, we stand adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.